The House Human Services Finance and Policy Committee will be brought to order. First order of business is approval of the minutes. Representative Gilman moves approval of the minutes from February 27th, 2025. Are there any additions, changes, or corrections to be made to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the minutes, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. The minutes from the motion is approved, and the minutes from February 27th, 2025 are adopted. First order of business today is a presentation from the Department of Human Services. Welcome to the committee. Please state your names for the record and present your findings.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Giogo Hayes, Division Director with the Department of Human Services. Thanks for the invite to be here today. Myself and my colleague, Ms. Grom, here will be doing a presentation from the outpatient rate study that the department did in partnership with a vendor that we contracted with. And so I believe it was the 2023 legislature passed some language requesting that the Department of Human Services embark on an outpatient rate study, mostly focusing on community-based physical health and mental health services, and we'll talk a little bit about the details of what's in the report in just a few minutes here. As mentioned, we did contract with a vendor, and we were happy to do the study as this was something that we were really interested in doing as well to update some rate methodologies for some specific reasons that I'll discuss in just a moment as well. You'll see here that a preliminary report was issued in 2023, and then the final report was published in January 2024, and that's essentially the content that we'll be covering today with the committee. In developing the rate study, our contracted vendor in partnership with DHS met with numerous community partners and talked with providers from all over the state, looking at all the different rate methodologies that we were looking at. And so through surveys through all the providers that do these particular services, as well as work groups that met over 30 times, as well as some in-person and individual meetings with providers, you'll find today the recommendations that come as a result of that collaborative effort. To ground us a little bit, it might be helpful to understand what we were trying to solve in the pursuit of this particular rate study. And I should just mention right at the outset as well, rates as a tool in order to ensure that providers can get reimbursed for the service that they can provide in an effort to ensure that members can receive the services that they need and want through the Medicaid program. And so today we're going to talk about the details of the study and the rate methodologies, but this is all in pursuit of ensuring that members have access to the services that they need. The study really looked to address these four components that you'll see here on the screen right now. One is to ensure that providers are receiving sufficient reimbursement for the services that provide, so again, members can have access to the services. Two is to address some methodologies that are very static, meaning that they don't change over time. And so for one tangible, as a kind of analog example, dental rates are static, and you've heard lots of conversation about dental access issues. We weren't able to update those. And so that's just kind of an example of a static methodology, so something we were attempting to look at in this study. And then lastly, for consistency and lack of transparency, the rates are pretty complicated. You'll see that probably in a few minutes here. And there's also a lot of rate add-ons and rate reductions that make that much more complicated. So it's very difficult for providers to understand easily what it is that they're going to get paid for a particular service without actually submitting a claim. And so those were the goals of the study. Just to ground us on what's in scope and out of scope, on the left side of the screen there, you'll see the in scope, so community-based physical, mental health, and substance use disorder services, as well as early intensive developmental and behavioral health services, or EIDBI services. Just for context, listed a couple things on the right side of the screen that are not in scope, just so we know that what we're looking at today. So I'm going to focus on the first portion of the study, and then Ms. Grom will take over with the balance. And so I'm going to talk today about the resource-based relative value system, or RBRVS. That's the methodology that we have in state law that we use to pay for the majority of our physical and mental health services. These make up for about 9,000 of about the 60,000 codes that we cover within the program and cover a wide range of services. The RBRVS system is looking at trying to assess cost the providers are incurring and then trying to set payment rates relative to each other so that rates that are paid to providers that are more expensive obviously get more reimbursement than services that are a little cheaper to provide. This is a methodology used by Medicare and set by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. They update this at least annually, but sometimes more frequently than that. And Minnesota adopted the use of this around 2011. However, we did it in a budget-neutral way, and I'll come back to that in a moment. This particular methodology set by CMS looks at several components that go into the delivery of healthcare in order to derive sort of what the reimbursement rate is. And so just on the screen here, you'll see some of the component parts that CMS looks at in deriving the rates. So they look at the work the provider's doing, the practice expenses, so is there a facility or a non-facility associated with that particular practice expense, as well as malpractice insurance that providers mostly usually carry as well. And then through that, derive sort of the relative value that I was mentioning. What you're seeing here is a bit of a depiction of that budget neutral concept that I mentioned. And so what this graph shows is what is the Medicaid program, what are we here in Minnesota, paying the providers relative, in the aggregate, relative to Medicare. And so we adopted, as I mentioned, this methodology around 2011. And you can see that in around 2013, we were paying about 80% of the Medicare rate for providers. And over time, because we do this in a budget-neutral way, when we update annually, we are spending the same amount of money that we spent the year before, but just tweaking the numbers. And as a result, you can see that over time, we have kind of lost relative to Medicare. And so as of 2023, which is when the report was published, we were paying around 74% of the Medicare rate. Again, that's in aggregate. And so kind of moving a little bit further down into detail, as I mentioned, we were paying around 74% of Medicare in the aggregate, but different rates can derive different percentages of Medicare. And so once again, just a reminder, this is a graph from the study that was done in 2023. So these numbers are slightly outdated, but it depicts the point that I'm trying to make here, which is that rates within the system can have different coverage percentages relative to Medicare. So these are the top 10 codes paid using the RBRBS methodology. Again, it's around 9,000 codes within our program. And you can see that based on the Medicare base rate plus all the different rate add-ons and rate cutbacks, which again we'll talk about in just a second here, you can see that rates sometimes get paid as high as 92%. For example, psychotherapy in the middle there, 92% of Medicare, whereas, for example, therapeutic activity at the bottom, 71% of Medicare. So there's a lot of differentiation in what rates providers are getting paid when you dive down into the details as well. I mentioned at the outset one of the goals of the study was to increase transparency. And so what I've described thus far for these particular providers is what we call the base rate. So it's where we start. And then from there, there have been several rate add-ons and rate reductions over the years, sometimes to address access, sometimes to address budgetary issues or other reasons. And those rate increases and decreases can impact the providers in very different ways. We have rate increases that are geographical. We have rate increases that are dependent on which provider does the service. We have rate increases dependent on sort of the severity of the service provided to the individual and all sorts of other reasons. And so as a result, when we have one particular code that's paid, it could pay differently depending on all those things I just mentioned, resulting in a very complicated rate methodology. And as I mentioned before, often makes it very challenging for providers to understand what am I going to get paid if I deliver this service. And so one of the goals here is to also increase transparency by if we change the rate methodology to remove some of these to account for that lack of transparency. And so the rate study as it relates to the RBRVS methodology makes three recommendations. One is to pay or adopt the Medicare rates. And so what that means is to pay equal to what Medicare would pay, 100% of what the Medicare rates are. Two is to continue the annual updates, but do that without the budget neutral component, which has resulted in sort of that negative sloping curve that I showed you earlier. And then three is to eliminate some of those rate increases and rate reductions so that we can increase the transparency for providers about how much they get paid for a specific rate. They would be able to look at the fee schedule, the number would be there, and that would be the rate that they would receive for the service. So with that, I'll turn just to Ms. Grom, who'll talk about the other methodologies from the report.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue with the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Christy Grom with the Department of Human Services. And I'm going to, as Mr. Hayes mentioned, just talk about the remainder of the rates that are covered by the study, which are not part of the RBRVS system. I believe most of the rates in this study are in RBRVS, maybe around 8,000 or so. And about 130 additional rates are not in that RBRVS system, meaning that Medicare doesn't have an analogous rate structure. And so In this part of, in this bucket, we're mostly focused on mental health services, substance use disorder services, and also EIDBI, which we're not going to cover in depth today. There is some crossover in RBRVS where we've got mental health services that are a part of that, that system, but some are not. And so that's what we'll focus on in this part of the presentation. So these are rates that are not currently cost-based rates. We do have a handful of mental health rates that are cost-based, meaning that we work with the provider community to send us how much it costs them to deliver services each year, and we update those rate methodologies annually or thereabout. So some of those cost-based rates that you might hear about would be things like psychiatric residential treatment facility, or PRTF. That is a cost-based rate structure that we're not talking about as a part of this report. Or our certified community behavioral health centers, or CCBHCs. Those are also cost-based or slightly nuanced prospective rates, data-based rates. So the handful of those rates we're not talking about today. We're really focusing on things like children's therapeutic services and supports and psychotherapy, all of those non-cost-based rates. So these are just kind of for a frame of reference. These are historic rates. So these were rates that were set by the legislature at a point in time. They might have had various updates throughout the years, but not a whole lot. And they've really stayed largely stagnant. And as Mr. Hayes mentioned, they're just not keeping pace with inflation, and they're not being reimbursed at a level that is commensurate with how much it costs to actually deliver that service. And that's where we're seeing some pretty significant issues in terms of access to mental health services in the community. So talking a little bit about how we work to build these rates that are not under RBRVS, we used what our vendor coined a market-based rate setting methodology. So we really took the goal of building these rate methodologies in a way that was easily understood, that was transparent, and based on the costs. And so, as Mr. Hayes mentioned, these rates were really largely arbitrarily set by the legislature back in the day, and so they aren't transparent. We don't know why they are what they are. And so with this methodology, we're looking at the various components that you see on the screen here or on your slide deck. So we looked at what are the direct staff worker wages and benefits, what are their salaries, what are their fringe benefits. We looked at, I believe, calendar year 2023. To understand what those salaries looked like. And then we took a look at direct staff time as another component of this methodology and tried to understand in surveys and working directly with the provider community how much of a worker's time would be spent in non-billable activities. So things like staff meetings or other administrative activities that are required as a part of delivering that service and doing that job well, but wouldn't necessarily be able to be billed. And so we use that information to calibrate the rate methodology accordingly. And then we looked at program-related expenses, so things that were specific to delivering a service. So a residential service is going to have a different program-related expenses than an outpatient psychotherapy visit. There's going to be maybe different levels of professional liability insurance, for example. So there's a variety of factors that we had to look at in this bucket to develop the rate methodologies. And then finally, we looked at administrative costs, so things like human resources, building expenses, insurances, insurance taxes, how much it costs to have an executive director, things of that nature. And so we used all of these components to pop out the final rate recommendations for all of these rates. And for those of you that are looking at the study in the index or in the appendix of the study, there is a large number of rate frameworks basically listing out what all of the current rates are and the recommended rates. As Mr. Hayes mentioned, those are a little bit outdated now because we've had some inflationary updates since then. But you can take a look at all of the specific rate recommendations as a part of in those indexes. So, and the next few slides, we'll just walk through kind of a snapshot of some of those indexes that I mentioned so you can get a sense of what the rate recommendations are as a part of the study, but wanted to just give you a sense of the scope. So we're included are the one-to-one and group mental health services that wouldn't be covered under RBRVS. So those are things like adult rehabilitative mental health services or CTSS, like I mentioned earlier, adult and children's mental health day treatment, outpatient and residential substance use disorder services, mental health provider travel time, which is sort of a unique service that we reimburse for, mobile crisis services, and behavioral health home services. So there were way too many mental health services to list on one slide, but we wanted to give you a sense of what some of the recommendations are here. And just for your awareness, overall, we saw in this report an aggregate increase of about 71% across all of the rates. We saw about 42% increase, 42% of rates were increased between 1 and 50%, and 29% were increased by over 50%. And there were a small handful of rates that, as we looked at the numbers and adjusted, saw some decreases. So about 11% of the rates had some minor reductions. But on the whole, we saw a very significant increase in rates as part of this recommendation. I noted this earlier, but just on the mental health side, it's really important to know that in working with our provider community and working, talking with people who use services, our advocacy community, we've heard some pretty concerning information about how long people are waiting to get services. So last year, I think we heard that children were waiting for intensive outpatient services for 14 weeks, which is a really long wait for someone who is in very critical need of services. And when we talk about the issue, I think we've talked about it in this committee in various forms. Yes, we have. We would talk about boarding, for example, in hospitals. We would expect that boarding and those issues of people getting stuck in inpatient settings would increase when we're not addressing our outpatient mental health services. So it's really critical that we get upstream and take a look at these rates and understand what they should be to make sure that people have access to services. So on the screen, you can see all of a variety of increases for some of the services that I mentioned. Moving to the next slide, behavioral health home. So a behavioral health home is not actually a home. It's an outpatient service for adults or children with emotional disturbance. So this was a newer service developed in 2016 in response to some of the barriers for people with co-occurring chronic health conditions and mental health issues. And so you can see right now we've got two different rates for this service. One is a beginning rate of $350 for the first 6 months, I believe, or six engagement sessions. And then there's that ongoing monthly rate of $250. And so the report is recommending that we consolidate those rates. And the numbers that when we looked at all of those cost components led to us to recommend about a $408 monthly rate. So you can see some pretty significant increases in those rates. And then for substance use disorder services, these are all, I believe, of the SUD services that we have both on the inpatient and outpatient side. And you can see that for low-intensity residential services, where we see the most disparities, they're about 170% below what we think they should be when we did this analysis with our vendors. High-intensity residential services are about 60% below where they should be. So we've heard a lot from the substance use disorder community about access to services as well, and we certainly see that the residential rates here are really the area that are exceptionally low and need to be addressed. I will note, some of you might be familiar with ASAM, or American Society of Addiction Medicine. We've been doing reforms in Minnesota to align with those evidence-based ASAM standards. And there was a new ASAM edition released in October of 2024. And so we've been working incrementally to align, and you'll see that in the governor's budget with some of our recommendations, align our rate structure with that new fourth or the fifth, don't quote me. These SUD rates were mostly focused on the prior edition of ASAM, so we might still have some work to do to just conform these once we require providers to align with all of those, the newer standards. So we wanna make sure that, as I mentioned earlier, that we're looking at the rates in the context of what are the requirements that the provider has, what does the clinical evidence say a provider should do, and then how can we make sure that we're reimbursing commensurate with that. And then this last slide was just a depiction that I thought would be helpful of just how disparate our substance use disorder rates are in terms of what they are right now for the high-intensity residential and low-intensity residential and where we believe they need to be. So we'll end with that and happy to take any questions that members might have.
All right. Mr. Reese and Ms. Grom, thank you for the presentation today. Are there any questions for the presenters, Representative Backer?
Thank you, Chair. I have two questions. First of all, on page 12, you reference many services are only covered under medical assistance. Unless I didn't hear it, what would be some of the services that are only covered by medical assistance?
Mr. Chair, Representative Backer, some of the services that come to mind are CTSS and ARMS, where those are more, it's sort of a bundled service model that some of the individual elements might be covered by commercial payers, but as a whole, that particular service is unique to Medicaid.
Okay. Representative Backer.
Next question I have is you just shared with us substance use disorder recommendation rates. Explain to us the steps and procedures used to come up with the recommended rates. Was this market-driven? Was this agency-driven, Fed-driven? Please, Chair.
Director Graham.
Mr. Chair, Representative Backer, these rates were also evaluated and decided on using that market-based methodology that I mentioned, so looking at working with providers and getting data from them about what their staff benefits are, what their staff salaries are, and then also, you know, the program expenses and admin, basically. With all of the rates, we do recommend inflationary updates to keep pace with inflation, and that's something that we have the legislature funded on the mental health side, but not on the substance use disorder side. So they were largely driven by information that we got from providers. We also worked with our vendor to make sure that we were looking at other states and that we weren't, you know, recommending something that was really out of the norm, but largely market-based.
Representative Backer.
Yeah, follow-up. Thank you. Did you see any of the providers here in Minnesota or across the borders that were having rates that are similar to that, or were all the rates closer to, a certain percentage lower than this rate?
Director Grom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Backer, I'm not sure for substance use disorder. I would have to go back and look. I know we have some analysis. I did take a look at a study from the National Institutes of Health from a couple of years ago, and I looked at mental health rates and some of the main codes that we use, and we generally landed about in the middle of the pack. Some states were paying way above, but I would have to get you more information on SUD.
Representative Backer.
Yeah, the only concern that I would have is, of course, any service would always want higher rates. It's how effective that they're using the rates. You know what I'm saying? So, and I don't have the information. Obviously, in front of me is how real are these recommended rates? That would be only my concern. Mm-hmm. Are we penalizing the ones that are being effective and providing quality service at a better rate? Or are we rewarding people who are don't have their pencil as sharp as the next one? So that's all I have. Thank you, Chair.
Director Graham.
Mr. Chair, Representative Backer, I think that's an important question that we do need to be analyzing, you know, what the outcomes are for substance use disorder services. We've seen very concerning numbers when it comes to overdoses, for example. Are these rates making a difference? Are the service models that we're developing making a difference in how people are, what the outcomes are for treatment? I would say that the legislature has required all of our provider groups now to become a part of the substance use disorder demonstration, which is an 1115 demonstration that requires that higher standard of services, so the ASAM standard. And in 2023, I believe, or it might have been 2021, residential providers were required to be a part of that demonstration, and then the last budget year, outpatient providers were. So now all providers are meeting those ASAM standards, and we are required to report to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services on specific outcome metrics, because as a part of that demonstration, we're able to pull down a federal match. for residential or IMD SUD services, which we weren't able to do before. So as a part of that agreement and us for to be able to get that federal funding, we actually have to show that our outcomes are improving. And I'd be happy to follow up with some of our recent data reporting to get you that information.
Any follow-up, Representative Backer?
No, thank you for, yes, I would appreciate that. Thank you. No other questions.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, Chair. Thank you so much, Director Grom. So I did have a bill last year to help identify some of those billing codes within ARMS and CTSS that are bundled that are being paid by commercials to help us try to streamline that so that we can have commercial payers pay first and not force families, particularly those of children with mental health conditions, onto medical assistance because the treatment that their child needs isn't covered by their commercial because of the way that we've done billing. Like, that's a problem we created, and it's a problem we can solve. So I'm looking forward to an update on where we're at on that. But that was not my question. Representative Backer just spurred that for me, so I wanted him to be aware that that's coming. We know that wait lists for things like CTSS, day treatment, are ridiculously long. Director Grom, you mentioned 14 months. I don't know about other Greater Minnesota members, but in or 14 weeks, thank you, Representative Gilman. I don't know about other Greater Minnesota members, but I'm hearing in my community that wait lists for things like CTSS skills, things like day treatment are months. I mean, like months. Like, I had someone tell me 6 to 8 months for CTSS skills is where they're running. And some providers have even shut down their wait list in Greater Minnesota. Like, they're not even putting anybody on the wait list anymore because it's so long. So I'm wondering if you could help me understand, given, you know, there's an increase here for day treatment of 13%. I don't see skills on here. But given some of those wait lists, do we think that there's like a direct correlation between the rates and those wait lists, or what, you know, what kind of solutions do we see? Because I will tell you personally, I think CTSS skills is the most effective treatment for kids with mental health conditions, because it allows them to take the things they're learning in therapy and practice them in community. And it saves us money because it prevents people from ending up on a waiver because things are more expensive. So I would really like to hear how we're going to address skills in the, or how we could address skills in the rate piece.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hicks, thank you for that important information from your area about what you're seeing in terms of wait lists. We do address CTSS skills training. So in the full report, which I'm not sure if you have access to that right now, but it's in the appendix. And so you can see there are several increases ranging from, I think, about 112% increase, at the lowest a 26% increase, up to 112% increase. So we are addressing, we are making recommendations for CTSS skills in this report. I mean, I think in terms of correlation, that's hard for me to, it's challenging to prove correlation that directly, but anecdotally we have heard from the provider community that that is definitely one of the services that they're struggling to provide, and that is really essential to the well-being of kids. So I can't give you a direct correlation, but maybe our provider community, who will be testifying on their bill in a bit here, can speak to that.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much. Skills, I think, is so important for kids, but it's also so important to bring folks into the field. It's where a lot of people get their first hours after their bachelor's degree, where they decide to go back and get their master's. And when we have destroyed the ability for skills to happen, nobody's providing skills, nobody's going into that, and it trickles up into our long-term workforce. It's an area that I just think we sort of forget about. And I think it's one of the blocks that has loosened and is really affecting our children's mental health crisis.
Thank you, Representative Hicks. Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the presentation. Quick question for, is it Mr. Reese? Is that right? Thank you so much. I was wondering, on page 9, when we're looking at the payment methodology, under what circumstances are people using therapeutic activities, the one that's coded 97530?
Mr. Reese.
Mr. Chair, I believe I'd have to look it up, but I believe that's either a PT, OT type of code, maybe a chiropractic code.
And then a follow-up on that, Chair, is the units Are they, so I looked it up a little bit on therapeutic activity. They're in 15-minute increments. So is the unit based on a 15-minute increment?
Mr. Race.
Mr. Chair, assuming that that's what you saw in the code, then this, yes, that'd be 712,000 15-minute increments, correct.
Wonderful. Representative Gilman.
Great. And just a fun fact, since we're starting a golf caucus, I thought it was interesting that you can, it's coded, swinging a golf club is in that, one of those activities that you can. So it's just anything to help someone get better, I mean, physically from an accident or, but I thought it was interesting, just the different things that people could code. Yeah.
Thank you, Representative
Thank
Gilman.
Thank you.
Representative Gander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to be clear on the presentation that we heard. Was the first half applicable to all kinds of service codes or just behavioral health?
Mr. Race.
Mr. Chair, the first half was applicable to a huge chunk of the Medicaid and Minnesota Care Program, around 9,000 codes. So anything paid by an MD, a physical therapist, occupational therapist, if you have surgery, the surgeon's cost, acupuncture, et cetera, a large chunk of the program.
Representative Gander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I know someone who bills all of those codes or most of them, 99214, 99213, 92014, 92013, which we're not on there. And I will say from talking to that person that the reimbursement in Minnesota is really hard to anticipate. Why? Because of the lack of transparency, and B, ridiculously low, much lower even than North Dakota medical assistance. And that might boggle your mind. So I would agree that bringing the objectivity, bringing the transparency, the consistency across, some way linking it to the reimbursement from Medicare would be a very sensible way. So if I could, my part two of the question, Mr. Chair.
Chair floor.
So while we're doing this effort to bring that objectivity, that transparency, that clarity, basically tying it to the Medicare reimbursement level, it seems like we're creating a similarly complex system now on behavioral side. We're kind of violating the thing that we're trying to do here, and we're going down that same rabbit hole here with all your factors on how to determine a behavioral code. Mm-hmm. So would you please help me reconcile those two? Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gander. Who would like that?
I can start, and then I'll pass over to Ms. Grom, Mr. Chair. Real quick, just to mention that in some instances, there are not analogs that are used in other areas of health insurance to pay for some of these codes, as Ms. Grom, and there was a question specifically about services that aren't covered. So, you know, I talked about RBRBS, and that is a large chunk of the rates that we pay, but I also showed earlier a section of the slides that said our services out of scope, right? And so if you think of inpatient hospital, federally qualified health centers, Indian health services, state operated dental, et cetera, they all use very similar methodologies that Ms. Grom mentioned. So I'll let her take it from there.
Director Grom.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's an important question to highlight, and that is not our intent, is to create more complexity. We're really trying to look at these historic rates that aren't based in any kind of costs and use a similar methodology, not the exact same as Medicare, but for example, in the Medicare RBRVS methodology, there's, I think, three main components, and those are very similar to the components that I described. So what does it cost for the professional to actually provide that service? What are, you know, what kinds of education and intellectual capacity do they need to provide that service? What kind of insurance do they need? What kind of administrative expenses are required to deliver that service? Those are very similar components to the RBRVS methodology. So we're just, because there isn't a Medicare analog, we're just creating something similar on for these other rates that fall into that camp.
Representative Gander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for that clarification. Would there be anything in private insurance carriers that would be an analog? Would that be one more little objective factoid that you could bring in? In other words, a regular insurance company that pays for that exact same service, you know they have gone through a similar sort of series of steps to come up with their reimbursement for that service. Thank you. Have you looked into that?
Director Grom.
What's that? Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't believe we have access to that information, even with our managed care organizations at DHS. I believe that we're prohibited from understanding the way that they're setting their rates, their reimbursements.
Representative Gander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe you wouldn't see into their system, but you could see their rates they pay, right? You'd see the dollar. You may not see into the, you know, behind the veil, but I guarantee you can get to what the rate they pay for that code, for that diagnosis. It's out there.
Thank you, Representative Gander. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. Thank you, Director Grom, for the presentation. Kind of picking up where Representative Gander left off. Working for a nonprofit that takes care of working in the mental health area for a very long time, I'll say that on the managed care organizations, it's next to impossible for the state to find out what's going on. And the reason I can say that, in the past, we have seen managed care organizations not follow through on state contracts and watching the state trying to get the information from the health insurance companies that had the contracts, they were next to impossible that for the health insurance companies to turn the information over. And I saw repeated emails going from the State Department of Human Services asking for information, and the people on the health insurance company that were copied included the chief operating officer, and they refused to respond month after month after month. So these are some of the problems that are out there. But I'm kind of digressing a little bit, but I couldn't miss this opportunity.
Thank you.
Director Grom, the big question, if we were to address the recommendations in this report around increasing all the rates for recommendations for the mental health and SUD area, can you give me a ballpark what we think that number may be? And I know you can't give me an exact number, but I know, and we've had this discussion last year when the report came out. What ballpark, where are we today approximately?
Director Grom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fisher, you know we don't like to do ballparks.
I know that.
But it's in the it's in the hundreds of millions. And it is, there are ways to scale that, many, many ways to scale that the legislature could consider. Of course, there's other creative ideas that we've seen out there this session. But I think that number is indicative of the fact that these rates have gone, have been underinvested in for many, many years. We've been focused on, you know, a lot of increases in waiver services and PCA, which is great. We need access to, you know, we need to look at the full continuum of services that people use under Medicaid. And many people use multiple services from different areas. But here there is a clear, clear imbalance. And that's why the numbers are quite high. Once we, you know, get the everything updated for the forecast, we'd be happy to provide a fiscal analysis on some of the bills that are moving at this time.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher, Director Grom. I know it's very expensive. I know it's something that we're never going to be able to solve entirely in one 2 year cycle. It's something that we're going to have to come back year, you know, session after session and just take bites at it as we go through. In terms of the dollars, when you get some kind of, you know, if we could get some kind of ballpark, and then also what the federal share of that is, because, you know, while it's going to take hundreds of millions of dollars right now, the feds would reimburse us, if I remember correct, with 50%, about 50%.
Director Grom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fisher, between 50 and 90%. So for the expansion population, we would expect to see a much higher reimbursement. So that is something that we're tracking very closely, what's happening at the federal level and proposed cuts that we're seeing that would really decimate services for people, particularly in behavioral health, in terms of, you know, we're already seeing a lack of access to these services. So reductions there would be really concerning for us.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. And in terms of the dollars as we're going forward, as we're trying to address these areas, one of the things I also wonder that ties into this is, if we do increases, so if any increases we do, we're going to bring down federal dollars. So we're getting a matcher that will help. So it seems like a wise error. If there's somewhere we're going to put dollars, this is something that can help. The other side of the question is that when we do this, this would impact fee for service. Is there anything we can do to guarantee that if we're increasing the fee for service, that the increases that are coming through are also going to be handled by the managed care organizations, because I've seen in the past managed care organizations sometimes pay more than fee-for-service, but also sometimes less. And if we're increasing reimbursement rates or the rates that we're paying the managed care organizations for providing these services, I want to make sure that those dollars are getting to where they go.
Director Grom.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yeah, so there are things that we can do. Over the past couple of years in 2022 and 2023, the legislature, 2023 and 2024, the legislature did increase, as you mentioned, incrementally some of these mental health rates and SUD rates. And as a part of that language that the legislature authorized, there was a requirement that that the capitation payments be adjusted accordingly. And so you can find that language in bills that passed, and we'd be happy to provide technical assistance, but that is an option that the legislature, a tool that the legislature has available.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. And then my question is going to move a little bit off rates in a way. One of the things I noticed that you're that I was picking up on as you were talking about the fact that a lot of these rates have been stagnant for so long. How much of an impact do you think that has had with the loss of the number of group homes that we have out there providing these services? I know that these part of the problems we have is as people are ready to go out of a very acute situation to a less acute situation, that the group home support isn't what used to be out there. Do you feel that the rates may have a contributing factor to that?
Director Grom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fisher, so when you say group home, I think you're maybe referring to children's residential facilities, which can be, you know, larger facilities, or they can be a smaller, more home-like facility. And those rates are actually negotiated between, I believe, the counties. So I don't even think there's, I think the state pays, there isn't a federal share, but the state basically pays the match that the county negotiates with the provider. So that's a negotiated rate, and it's not a part of the rates in this study. So I couldn't really speak to those. I think we'd have to do a deeper analysis of what all of those rates are by facility and how counties are reimbursing. And we would have to get back to you with more information on that probably.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. Thank you for that. That's very helpful information. Thank you for that education.
Thank you, Representative Fisher. Any other questions for the presentation? Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the presentation. Just wanted to understand more about the transparency, the increases and decreases. I don't know if how that will really balance the targets that we're trying to achieve with the rates.
Director Grom. Mr. Race.
Mr. Chair and Representative, in discussions with providers and in an attempt to increase the transparency and potentially a federal rule that we're required to do it, our hope would be that if we were able to get to 100% of Medicare, that all the rates would go up and we could eliminate all those rate increases and decreases that exist today. So like if you're getting, looking at the chart here, like if you're getting 71% of Medicare, that might include a 5% rate increase or 2% reduction, et cetera. So our hope would be we'd raise them all and then eliminate all that kind of noise that's in the middle and kind of say, the rate is the rate, and that would allow providers, like I mentioned earlier, you go on the fee schedule, you look at the code that you want to bill, and you look at the rate, and that would be what you get paid.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you for that explanation, because it was a little bit confusing when you say you're going to reduce 20% reduction for master's, level mental health providers. So the other question that I have is, knowing that we wanted to follow the recommendations, you said it's scalable. With that methodology of trying to increase and decrease, how can we meet that level of increases with only limited resources that we think we may be able to find somewhere?
But Mr. Chair, it sort of depends on what our limited resources are. There are all sorts of different ways to scale this proposal, as Ms. Grom mentioned a few minutes ago as well. You can see that they're just on this screen. These are just the top 10 codes of a slight section of the study, and there's rates all over the board here, right? So it's going to take some effort to figure out, depending how much we're willing to spend, how we can try to get everybody to slowly move up or target some positions to move up without having any harm. But there are endless possibilities on how to do that. And so we could certainly start speculating about a couple, but it could be here for a while.
Representative Knorr.
My final question, Mr. Chair. Can we get some assumptions if there's an increase by 5%, 10%, 30%, just assumptions that you think will meet some of the needs to really address this issue.
Mr. Reese.
Mr. Chair and members, I mean, it's certainly something we could provide technical assistance on. I would say that I would recommend us having some more intentional conversation about that, because if you look here, for example, this is 2023 data, excuse me, there were some rate increases that applied. Just using this as a tangible example, there are some folks that are already really close to 100% of Medicare. And so if you do 5%, you're going to put some people over Medicare while other people go from 71 to 76%. That's really easy math, it's not quite accurate, but you take my point. And so I think some intentional conversation around what areas we want to target and how do we slowly, as Representative Fisher mentioned, if we're not going to do it all at once, how do we slowly move everybody that direction without kind of setting us up where we're have some people that continue to get more than other folks and kind of negotiate and all that. But certainly if there are ideas by the committee, we can certainly help provide technical assistance on that front.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions for the presenters? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your presentation today. Up next, House File 1005. This will be a joint presentation from Representative Bierman, Representative Baker. And as they're making their way in and getting settled in, I will move that House File 1005 be laid over for possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill. Welcome to the committee. Whenever you're ready, please introduce yourself and present your bill.
I'll jump in. Just good morning, members, and thank you for having me. I'm proud to co-present today with Representative Bierman, who's going to start it off. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher and committee members. Thank you for taking the time to hear this, our bill, which is foundational to continuing to build the healthcare system necessary to meet the needs of Minnesotans, specifically Minnesota children who have been at the forefront of a mental health crisis that must be addressed. Before we get into the bill, I would like Mr. Chair to move the DE1, please, to get the bill in its most current version.
And I will move the DE1 amendment. Are there any questions to the DE1 to get the bill in the shape that the author would like it? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the DE1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. The amendment is adopted. Representative Bierman, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This amendment does not include any major policy changes. It makes technical updates to streamline and simplify the mechanics of increasing reimbursement rates. I wanted to again start by thanking the DHS folks, Ms. Director Graume and Mr. Hayes, for presenting their outpatient rate study. That presentation gives us all a good grounding in why this bill is needed. House File 1005 implements the mental health and physician service components of DHS's study and increases a few other mental health rates not included in the study. I'll get more into the details of the bill components later. We all know that medical assistance, or MA, is critical for health care coverage in Minnesota. Nearly a quarter of all Minnesotans from every corner of our state rely on MA for their health care. This includes over 40% of all babies born in our state. And, as we just heard, reimbursement rates to providers who serve these Minnesotans have fallen woefully behind the cost of delivering care. Our current rates are unsustainable and have created a crisis in access to care. We've taken initial steps to implementing the rate study, and there's much more ground left to cover. Members, you have numerous letters in your packet from hospitals, community mental health providers, physicians, and diverse community partners that illustrate the magnitude of the problem we are trying to solve and its impact on all of our communities. We know that our system has reached a breaking point. Too many children and families are waiting weeks, months, or in some cases years to access the care that they need. When it comes to mental health, more and more of these children end up boarding in a hospital, juvenile detention, or with the county because families have lacked access to early intervention and intensive community-based care. We can fix this access to care crisis by increasing reimbursement rates while simplifying payment structures and increasing transparency. Now I'll turn it over to Rep. Baker to share some of his thoughts before I walk through the bill.
Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I want to echo Representative Bierman's thanks again for this really important discussion today. You all know, for me, working on treatment for substance use disorder and mental health disorders is personal. Many of us have worked together to make a positive change on these systems over the years, and those changes have made, I think, a real positive impact. But foundational to the access issues we are experiencing are clearly now the low MA reimbursement rates that we're finding ourselves in. We'll continue to hear from testifiers today about the crisis of the boardings in the hospitals and providers having to make tough decisions and about whether they can continuing offer these services or not. And to Representative Hicks's comment, how long the waiting lists are. These really matter right now. Mental health and substance use disorder providers are shrinking or closing their doors around Minnesota because they cannot hire and retain staff. And more physicians and other health care providers are unable to serve those most in need because the cost of providing care has increased while reimbursement rates have literally remained flat. We did hear earlier this year, too, that 80% of children's mental health providers reported that they would likely have to cut their services or close their doors altogether in the next 6 to 12 months if we don't do something. These closures and shrinking services are felt especially in rural Minnesota, where access to health care has been a real issue for years. It's time to finally address the foundational issue causing the stress on our system. And also, members, we have to realize doing nothing this year is also going to be making sure that we're going to go backwards because we have new employer mandates coming out with paid family medical leave that put more pressure on the administration side to make sure that the workers will have the ability to be there for our patients. But with paid family medical leave too, it's a good program. We need to support a version of something that will work. More providers will be out for probably a little longer time. We have to recognize that. So these, it all starts with good reimbursement rates. And that's what we need to do here today. The phased implementation proposed in this bill encourages us to think long-term about how we're going to solve this problem because this is a major issue in front of us and we all know that because everybody sitting here wants to do something. But we don't have unlimited dollars. We have to think about this in a very planned, methodical manner. This bill also sits nicely alongside other bill that increases our substance use disorder rates as described in the DHS study. Both bills are urgently needed, and I'm glad to hear to support them and try to figure out how we can start this phased-in approach, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Representative Baker. And I understand you have a few presenters for...
Well, I have a few more comments about the bill itself. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Baker, for your comments. Our bill implements the remainder of the mental health and physician services recommendations in DHS's rate study. This includes ensuring reimbursement rates for mental health and physician services that have an equivalent Medicare payment will be paid at least 100% of the Medicare fee and schedule, and increasing community-based children's and adult mental health rates and behavioral health home rates to the DHS study calculation, as these rates do not have an equivalent in Medicare. In addition to implementing these study recommendations, the bill also ensures the master's level providers are reimbursed the same amount as other clinicians when using the same billing codes, and increases funding for hospital inpatient mental health services delivered to fee-for-service Medicaid enrollees. These increases are phased in over 3 years. The first phase is effective January 1st, 2026, and increases mental health and physician service rates that have a Medicare equivalent, as well as all other children's mental health community-based services that don't have a Medicare equivalent. The second phase starts in 2027 and increases rates for all other adult community-based mental health services that don't have a Medicare equivalent, as well as increases rates for master's level clinicians by repealing their current cutback. The third and final phase is in 2028 and increases rates for behavioral health homes and fee-for-service hospital inpatient mental health services. These rate increases impact almost all outpatient providers, from mental health to physicians to APRNs to physician assistants. We are all well aware of our current financial forecast as a state, and this proposal requires significant state resources. This is why we've proposed a phased approach and are very much looking forward to continued conversations about what steps we can take this year and next year and the following year. Our provider communities and Minnesotans can't wait any longer. We now have three testifiers to speak to the impact of this bill. Please, Mr. Chair, we'll go to the testifiers.
All right, if they could please make their way forward. And in however order you wish to present. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Rolit Vivedi. I'm Dr. Rolit Vivedi, and I'm the president of Minnesota Academy of Family Physicians, representing more than 3,100 members across the state. I'm testifying today in support of House File 1005 on behalf of the Minnesota Medical Association and Minnesota Academy of Family Physicians. I'm a family physician practicing at the Community University Healthcare Center, a federally qualified healthcare center in South Minneapolis. Most of my patients are on Medicaid. I see them relying on medical assistance for their healthcare coverage to access primary care. The increased reimbursement rates proposed in this bill will improve access to care and advance health equity for all Minnesota patients in every corner of the state. In addition, it will help clinics throughout the state stay in business and avoid having to merge with larger systems. Ensuring access to primary care allows Minnesotans to access preventive care as well as ongoing management of their chronic condition. Investing in primary care by addressing the unsustainable medical assistance reimbursement rates help keep patients out of emergency rooms and needing hospital stay. Countless studies have demonstrated that investment in primary care ultimately saves the overall healthcare system money. Focusing first on access, the number of Minnesotans who depend on MA has grown substantially over the years. Today, about 1 in 4 Minnesotans are covered by MA, and more than 40% of the babies born in Minnesota are covered by MA. Unfortunately, there has not been an access across the board increase in MA rates in decades. Currently, MA reimburses 60 to 70% of what Medicare pays and only about 30% of what commercial insurance pay. These rates have fallen too far behind, and when rates can't keep up, services are cut, communities are left without care, and patients suffer as a result. Just this past week, I took care of several patients who would have either gone to emergency care or not seek care at all without MA. It included a Somali young man with severe persistent mental illness who lives in a group home and has a diabetes but does not like checking his blood sugars. This past Saturday, I got a call at 5:30 in the morning that his sugars were 606. I spent several hours to control his diabetes over phone as he will only listen to us or the group home owner. During those hours, I was at the pharmacist, I was the social worker, dietitian, psychiatrist, care coordinator, and primary care provider. I was able to provide excellent care managing his insulin, provided him education about food and diet, and also managed his psych condition. He was happy that he was not sent to the ER, which led to increased trust, good patient experience, and also reduced the total cost of care. It did not stop there. I came back to the clinic on Monday morning, and the first thing I asked one of the nurses to call the patient to check up on if he was taking his insulin. Having all these services is costly, but improve care significantly and reduce the cost, and current Medicaid rates do not cover the cost of all these efforts that our patients are needing in supporting their health. I also heard a story from our dental clinic. We saw a kiddo, 13-year-old, last year who came to the clinic and did not have any insurance, and she came to the clinic with a pus oozing from her chin, was seen in the medical, was started on the antibiotic, and immediately was sent for an x-ray in our dental clinic, and it showed that one of her tooth was coming out of the chin, and that was causing the infection. We made a decision that she needed a maxillofacial surgery but did not have the insurance, and it took us several weeks, but we finally got her on the MA, and I was able to consult with the pediatric surgeon, maxillofacial surgeon, 1 year, and the school, and 1 year later she had the surgery, and her disfigurement of the face was avoided, and so her life is changed because of the MA. Increasing rates will also advance health equity. Currently, Minnesotans on MA are disproportionately rural and traditionally underserved areas. You have information in your packets pointing out which Minnesota counties have higher rates of patients on MA. These patients live in every corner of the state, and in fact, as a greater percentage of MA patients live in greater Minnesota. Increasing these rates will help ensure those in these regions, our neighbors and their kids, are not left behind. I'm privileged to be sitting here, but I know I have a lot of colleagues who provide care in rural Minnesota and all over, and there a lot of them are at the verge of closing their services. Physicians remain committed to serving Minnesotans on MA. This program is critical to ensuring access to care for all Minnesotans. However, the failure to update reimbursement rate is forcing difficult business decisions for many services. It is time to update MA payments to at least the Medicare level. Thank you for the time today, and thank you so much for giving me this opportunity, and I'm happy to help answer any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Devadi, for your testimony. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher and committee members. My name is Jessica Brisbois, and I am a licensed clinical social worker and the manager of acute mental health services at Children's Minnesota. I appreciate you having me here again to discuss what must be done to address the mental health needs of Minnesota kids. The crisis kids and families are facing continues to grow more critical, and solutions are desperately needed. There is a lack of mental health services in our state, and children are waiting for months to access care, often utilizing the emergency department as a last resort. In 2024, kids boarded at Children's Minnesota more than 1,200 times, a substantial increase from the year prior. This increase reflects the consistent trends we've seen each year since 2022. 77% of the patients we see boarding in our hospital, and almost half of the patients served by our mental health programs, rely on Medicaid, which is why increasing Medicaid rates is vital to addressing the challenges providers are facing. The parents and guardians of these children have often recognized their child's need for support, but have run into barriers accessing outpatient services, including long wait lists. While waiting, their child's mental health gets worse, which is what brings them to the emergency department. The last time I testified before you, I expressed my concern regarding the lack of access to the community-based services. This problem has continued to grow. We continue to see the capacity of mental health providers shrinking because of inadequate reimbursement rates. In order to remain safe and successful outside the hospital, children need outpatient mental health services. Currently, we cannot always guarantee access to these services, even for patients that are discharging from the hospital after a serious mental health crisis. This leads to more families returning to us after not being able to access appropriate care. These families are defeated and exhausted because the system continues to fail them. Across all of our mental health services, we are reimbursed for less than half of our costs, and as costs continue to rise, that level of reimbursement is getting worse. The current rates are unsustainable. On average, we operate these vital services at a loss, severely limiting our ability to recruit and retain staff needed to meet the growing needs of our patients and their families. This contributes to long wait lists and why most of our outpatient services are only available to current Children's Minnesota patients. One of the biggest impacts we can have on the mental health crisis is investing in outpatient care. That investment would decrease pressure on the rest of the system, including emergency departments, inpatient units, and other more acute services. Most importantly, it would give children and families a better chance of addressing their mental health needs. We all want to build a system where kids and families are never in crisis. We all want to see children be able to get the help they need when they need it. Foundational to doing that is making sure Medicaid reimbursement rates are adequate. We will not see meaningful change unless we take this step. Thank you, Representative Bierman, for your leadership on this bill, and thank you, committee members, for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Brisbois, for your testimony today. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
My name is Julie Hannenberg. Mr. Chairperson, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. As I said, my name is Julie Hannenberg. I am an LICSW, and I am the founder and executive director of Lighthouse Child and Family Services. We provide school-based, school-linked behavioral health services, day treatment programming, and outpatient services across 10 rural counties in central Minnesota. In 2022, we were forced to close our in-home children's mental health program due to insufficient reimbursement rates. This decision has had a devastating impact on our rural communities, and it has significantly decreased access to care in an already underserved and impoverished area. We served a four-year-old young girl named Sally. She was referred to us because she was expelled from child care and Head Start and struggling to be safe at home due to her explosive behaviors. With in-home skills and therapy, Sally and her parents gained new strategies and skills and developmental supports that helped her stabilize and start to thrive in Head Start and at home. These low-cost, high-impact services helped preserve the family and supported Sally to become a successful kindergartner. Providing early intensive interventions does decrease long-term mental health crises and costs. Unfortunately, Lighthouse's closure is not an isolated case. The capacity for children's mental health services has decreased significantly across the region, worsening the crisis for children and families who urgently need early intervention and community-based care. In fact, a survey conducted in January revealed that 80% of children's mental health providers expect diminished capacity or program closures within the next 6 to 12 months. Current Medicaid reimbursement rates are often 40% below the cost of providing services, making it increasingly difficult for organizations like ours to hire and retain qualified staff. As a result, children and families are going even longer without the care they need to thrive. I am deeply concerned about the growing mental health crisis and the increasing inability to deliver timely and intensive services. House File 1005 represents a critical opportunity to address these issues by fixing reimbursement rates for mental health services. These rates are essential for maintaining the well-being of children and families. Without adequate funding, we risk further destabilizing our communities. However, with appropriate investments in reimbursement rates, we can stabilize and support the children and families who rely on us. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Hannenberg, for your presentation, and thanks to you to all three for helping present on this bill today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members.
Next for public testimony, Dr. Steve Girardo. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee, for hearing me today. My name is Dr. Steven Girardo. I am a co-chair of the Legislative Committee for the Minnesota Psychological Association. I'm also the Federal Advocacy Coordinator representing Minnesota to APA and to the federal government. I am also Executive Director for Mental Health Systems, which we have five brick-and-mortar clinics in the Twin Cities, and we also provide outstate services through telehealth. I'm here in support of the bill, but I have a comment, an observation, and a part of the bill I have a problem with. The comment is that we are, of course, in a mental health crisis. There is absolutely no way that anybody can argue that there isn't a mental health crisis. This was in play for a very long time related to rates. It was exacerbated by COVID, which ended up closing a lot of programs that were for intensive services because they couldn't do their services during the COVID pandemic, and those services could not be afforded to restart. Anybody who's ever started a business knows you don't need just running expenses. You need running expenses for a number of months before you're actually going to be receiving income. So a lot of these programs are not being replaced. The bill actually does make steps towards trying to fix the problem. I think one of the committee members already mentioned that it's a step in the process. It's not a completion of the process. My comment is that the RBRVS system, it was identified by people from DHS as actually coming from CMS. It is not a CMS entity. It is a committee from the American Medical Association that serves, and it's a volunteer committee. And there are no behavioral health providers that are part of the committee that sets rates for the general outpatient codes. Now, for psychological testing and codes that are just for psychology, then there are psychologists there that are talking about it. But all of those relative value units are being determined by medical doctors, not by behavioral health specialists at all. And that's a problem that I'm trying to address and APA is trying to address at the federal level. But the data is under, it underrepresents the actual costs of things because they're trying to determine what our costs are and they're not providing that same service. So I don't think we have a methodology to tie to other than that system right now, but just understand that that system is flawed and will underreport what the costs are for mental health services. And I'm not saying anyone's intentionally doing anything wrong, but the way the system is set up is flawed. And so I think that's one of the steps we need to look at later. And like I said, it's one of the steps that we're looking at federally as well. The opposition that I have is just in the repealer, in the repealing of the pay differential for doctoral level psychologists over as opposed to master's level clinicians. And the reality is that pay differential, if you eliminate it, you basically are starting the process of eliminating psychology at the doctoral level as a profession. Because you have to go to school for 2 more years of classes and 1 more year of in-person training before you start getting hours for your licensure. The cost of that schooling is more than double the cost of getting a master's degree to get a license as a master's degree, but you also lose 3 years of income. I've had students that have come out of our program that we do internship training, part of our giving back to the communities. We train interns and social work interns and all those other licensures. I had an intern I was supervising, and she said she and her husband made a decision not to have children because they couldn't afford to have children and have a house and move on with their lives because they came out of school with $250,000 worth of debt to get the education. The current debt load coming out of medical school is less than the debt load to come out for psychologists. Why does that matter? One of the things that's been talked about, it sounds like it's equivalent service, so why aren't we paying the same? It's not equivalent service because the provider does not have the same level of training and education. I was a master's level psychologist back in the day. I've got the gray hairs enough to have been grandfathered in as a master's level psychologist. I went back and got my doctorate because I knew that there was more to know. And I got value for my additional 3 years of education and the money I paid for that education. And my clients got value for that. And I don't know anybody who could successfully argue that 2 more additional years of education classes and 1 more year of in-person training does not change the quality of work. Why this is especially important for this bill is that people on MA are the most complex cases that we're going to have in aggregate in our state. They're the most vulnerable people that need the highest level of services. They need doctoral level psychology. And as it currently stands, a lot of doctoral level psychologists are finding ways to pay their bills by going into the private pay industry, where they have somebody come in and pay them privately, and they can actually pay off their loans and do okay financially. I've not chosen to do that. I don't need lots and lots of money, but I need enough money to pay for our staff. And that is a staffing problem. And that we've heard testimony from other people saying it's hard to hire people. It's really hard to hire doctoral level people. And we do take MA and Medicare. And so we're working with those really complex cases. And so if we don't fund a difference in licensure, if we repeal the 80% the 20% difference between the two pays, we're literally not going to have doctoral level psychologists. And the Minnesota Department of Health did a study a number of years ago talking about there just being a crisis in doctoral level psychology because we're not replacing ourselves at the rate that we're going. Currently, over 55% of psychologists are 55 and older. They all look like me and maybe a little younger, but if we don't fund the licensure, we're going to lose the expertise of psychologists. And I do understand that, you know, the code is the code, but if we don't have a different code for doctoral level psychology that pays at a different rate, you can't You can't change the payment rate and not have a really significant impact on our community.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Girardo.
That's great. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 1005? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. Questions from members? Representative Backer.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Roughly, what type of price tag are we looking on this to raise the rates to be at 100%?
Representative Bierman.
Mr. Chair and Chair Backer, we did hear from the department on that it's in the some hundreds of millions, but we are still waiting on the fiscal note. And so we're going to have to find out what that is. It'll be coming soon. And once we have that, then we will be able to dive in a little bit more to kind of determine, once we have the budget out and we know what kind of money we have to deal with, we can see how much of this we can take on this year. But I don't have a price tag on this whole three-phase approach at this time.
Representative Backer.
Thank you.
Representative Gilman.
Thank you so much, Chair. Curious if House File 1005 recognizes the rate study that we just got today on page 21. The behavioral health reimbursement rate, is that included in this bill? Thanks.
Representative Bierman?
On page 21, I don't have that report in front of me right now, but this behavioral health, if it's mental health, this one is dealing with the outpatient, as we described in the bill, for children, adults in this phased approach. So yes, behavioral health is being covered in this, with Medicaid being raised up to the Medicare rates, which is really our solution to strengthen the entire continuum of care and address the shortage of access that we're seeing for children and adults across the system.
Representative Backer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Gilman, good question. Not really.
No.
But it's part of it. But Representative Bierman is not wrong on this at all. But again, I know that these two studies are very, but a lot of the SUD was included in this overall study. This bill is not so much addressing it as maybe others have seen. I think Representative Frederick might be working on sort of like the other March side of things, which really kind of comes around with that. So it is massive. And I think this is, this covers a huge part of it. And the SUD side of things are off to the side. It's kind of, I think, walking a little bit in parallel, but I haven't had a chance to follow up with that one as much. But it's a great question, and this one is not all about the SUD as well. So that's another part of it later. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, the behavioral health, when I'm talking to people about behavioral health, it often is also encompassing both, because there's so much commingling of mental health and SUD. So behavioral health to me is that entire umbrella. And so if we want to talk SUD, that we can talk about that on its own, but we can talk about mental health on its own. But you have to realize there's a big section in the middle that it encompasses both. So, yeah.
And Representative Bierman, I just have to say, I kind of chuckled there when you responded, not so much at you or the response, but just how honest, because you don't see that around here as much. Representative Gilman. All right. Any other questions for the bill presenters? Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. I guess I don't really have a question. I more just want to make a statement and I guess a notion of gratitude for bringing this forward. Mental health in our kids is something that is massive. And I've sat in a lot of conversations, and I think I just want to recognize that it's not just about getting the services you need at that time. Some of the tables that I've sat at, particularly around ending homelessness. You know, when we don't have the supports we need to address mental health services, it increases the likelihood that individuals become unsheltered. So this bill addresses that. Another table I've sat at a lot lately is around attendance and truancy. And when we don't support our kids at the highest level that they need, they miss school. And we all agree that kids need to be in school. And our school systems are saying our teachers and our schools are not designed to support the mental health needs that our kids are coming to school with. So we need to have these services in the community. The fact that 80%, I think is what I'm hearing over and over, like, of doors could close. Is that what you said? That's terrifying, like emotionally terrifying for me as somebody who deeply wants to support inclusive, accessive care around mental health. But also, this is family preservation. You know, we talk so much about keeping our families together and providing the needs that they have. And, you know, family preservation is saving lives, is keeping our kids alive, is making sure we have the birthdays and the celebrations that they deserve to have with us. And so really just coming forward as a bipartisan way to do what is right for our kids, I think is an example of how we can do this work this year. And I am just really grateful for you two stepping up to do this. And our kids really need this. And I think that I know we have little money to spend, but when we invest in the health of our kids, it's just so invaluable in the future. So thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Keeler. And Representative Bierman, Representative Baker, just to follow up a little bit more, I wanted a little more clarification on Representative Gilman's question there about what of this study is included in your bill under the DE1 versus what else might be out there. We have this whole rate model chart there in Appendix B. Could you just help kind of walk us through what is and isn't in there, if you're able to?
I don't have a list.
Okay, good.
I believe here. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Keeler, for your comments. I think I'll talk about a couple of those things when I close as well, but I appreciate your comments on this bill and the working together on this. What's included in the bill are behavioral health homes, OBGYN, primary care, physician professional services, outpatient mental health, that includes therapy for individual and family group, psychiatry, psychological and neuropsychological testing, assessments, CTSS, which we talked about, children therapeutic supports and services, the skills, the ARMS that was referenced earlier, so that's adult rehabilitative and mental health services, peer services, in-home therapy, marriage and family therapy, clinical counseling, crisis services. So those are all covered. And then in addition, the rate study recommendations, the elimination of the 20% master's level cutback. So master's level would be paid for the mental health services they are providing at the full rate. And then fee-for-service inpatient hospital mental health rates via rebasing. So that's what's included. There's a list of what's not included in this bill as well. If you'd like to hear that, I can read that down as well, but that'll be coming in the next one.
Okay. Yeah, if you could just go over that quickly, just so I can get organized.
So what's not included, adult day treatment, EIDBI, hospital, dental, pharmacy dispensing fees, EMS, SUD under 245B, residential treatment, withdrawal management, group treatment, behavioral health fund, sober homes, opiate disorder, SUD recovery, peers, SUD treatment coordination. And then we listed previously, we heard about some of the things from DHS that are on a different cost basis, FQHCs, CCBHCs, PRTFs, IRTSs, and ACTs, CRFs, and Indian Health Services, IHS. I can spell all those initials out, too, if you like. Those are all, you know, certified community behavioral health clinics, psychiatric residential treatment facilities, intensive residential treatment, and assertive community care and treatment. So a long list on both sides. We're doing a lot. The next bill will cover a lot of those other sides to that. But it's comprehensive. It needs to be because we have a need that is great, that has been getting larger in all the years I've been up here in the legislature, and it's time to really take a big step forward.
Thank you, Representative Bierman, and thank you for that list, too. It's helpful just to understand, just kind of, this gives us the full scope of what they were able to do, and then to correlate that with the bills and the buckets that those are all trying to work with here. I think that makes sense. So that was very helpful. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher, and thank you, Representative Bierman and Baker, for doing all the work on this. I know this is an area where we've had very strong bipartisan support over the years, and I think it's something that it's really nonpartisan. We all agree, and everyone in this country agrees, that we need to do more to help build up our behavioral health system out there. The question I've got, because I know we talk a lot about the Medicaid rates, getting those changed. When I take a look at 6 and 5, though, I notice that we've got dollars specifically called out for inpatient behavioral health services. I'm wondering if those, and this might be one more for the department, as I see $10 million in fiscal year 2028, $10 million in 2029, are either those amounts able to be offset at all by the Medicaid rates with federal match, or is that all just going to be just straight the $10 million from the general fund?
Who would like that?
Let's just get the department up to confirm that question. I think that would be wise if it would come up.
You can see why I'm asking the question. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mr. Race, welcome back to the committee.
Mr. Chair and members, usually with language like that, we assume that there's a federal match, so it would be $10 million in aggregate spending. So we would spend an additional $10 million. Some of that would be federal, some of that would be state.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you. So thank you, Chair Schumacher. Thank you. So if we spend $10 million, then another $10 million from the feds will come in, or we're going to spend the $20 million in total, but 10 of that will come from the feds?
Mr. Race.
Mr. Chair, we're going to spend $10 million total. So if you were to really, really simplify the math and call it 50-50, although that is really oversimplified, it's going to be $5 million from the state general fund and $5 million from the federal government. Okay. But again, usually it's closer, more like a 60-40 when you blend everything together.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you so much. That's kind of what I thought, but I didn't want to make that assumption. Thank you.
Any other questions for House File 1005? All right. Final comments. Representative Baker, then Bierman.
Yeah, I'll go first, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. I just want to thank Representative Bierman for kind of leading the charge on this. We have done a lot of discussions about this, even during the interim. And when it came for this year, kind of knowing the layout of our makeup this year, we knew that the more we did together like this, I think the more we're trying to recognize the importance of it for what it is. This is a huge nut. I'll say a number because I asked the number offline, and it's around $350 million. If we had it all today, that's what it would take. Now, we're asking for a phased-in approach on that. Now, I don't know how close it is, and I'm not going to get quoted either because nobody's going to care what I say, but they care what the department says. But I think as I ask that question, we're thinking at $100, $150 million for phase one, give or take. I don't know. But this outpatient services is really key, as you heard earlier, to help people early on when they can still function and be home, and to save more workers that will stay out in rural Minnesota so our centers are not closing. This is a big deal, and I've heard about this since the day I walked into the legislature 10 years ago. All of my work with the opioid stuff and the ORAC, the Opioid Advisory Council, we talk about this and we see this, and it's crippling us because the great work we have done here in the last several years is only going to go to waste if we don't have people there to take care of them. And if we don't keep up, and if we don't keep up with the things coming at the operators and the centers, again, workforce rules matter. Workforce costs matter. And it comes right down to this. If we can't keep up with the MA rates and Medicaid rates, we are going to lose all of our advances that we've done over the last few years. So I know this is hard to ask for. It's a lot of money. But when you want to get serious about mental health, substance use disorder, it's going to start with a bill like this. And so I just appreciate the work ahead of you all and all of us and the hard decisions that are in front of all of us. And again, Representative Bierman is a champion on this, and I'll work with him as long as he'll have me around. But again, I just know this is a This is a bipartisan problem that we need to get our arms around. So thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Mr. Chair, I just want to thank Rep. Baker for all of his work. He's been diligent from the day I met him and the first day up here, and just appreciate the good work and the solid approach he takes to taking all of this very seriously, very thoroughly, and finding the best solutions for the state of Minnesota. We had Dr. Roiley up here earlier. Hopefully that's, you don't need to come up. I just wanted to comment on a conversation we had one day regarding where you work in the FQHC, and you made the comment that the healthcare issues that you deal with, rates affect all of that. It affects your ability as a primary physician. It affects your ability to hire workforce. It affects your ability to truly treat patients before they disappear and go to the emergency room for care instead of being treated as you can so aptly treat them. So rates affect everything. And when we don't have the services in community, what happens? Patients don't get the care they need, their conditions become more chronic and difficult, and they end up in the emergency rooms. If you've talked to your local hospital, you've heard about this. This is a serious condition that is not getting better, it's getting worse, and we need to deal with it now. And I think that the other side of this is schools, you know. If we aren't treating kids in school, I mean, or at getting them treatment either in a day program that I visited a couple of years ago, which has now closed, by the way. They were taking kids to that day program, getting the mental health treatment that they needed, and back to school and back and forth, and they were getting the services they needed. They are no longer, and that was in a urban area very close to my home. So they are closing. The enormity of the problem is getting bigger. You have all signed up for this committee, so you get to be helpful in the solution, and this is the year to address it. So thank you for your work here, thank you for being here, and thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Representatives Baker and Bierman, for presenting on House File 1005 today. With that, House File 1005 is laid over for possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill. And with no further business on the agenda, we stand adjourned and get to come back Wednesday, March 5th at 8:15.